From the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, current events, and issues that matter to you. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, we're looking at the effect of the Affordable Care Act in Utah. Far more Utahns signed up for health coverage under the new law than the government had expected. What are the reviews so far? And what about the penalties those who haven't signed up are facing, and also the credits that are available under the new law to help people pay for insurance? Today we're looking at so-called Obamacare, 6 months after its launch date, with Take Care Utah's Randall Sear.
It's fascinating because the goal that we had at the beginning, and this was given to us by the federal government, was to sign up 57,000 people just through the website in Utah. And so we exceeded that goal by 148%.
Plus your top local headlines and more just ahead on The Rundown here on KCPW. And welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up a little bit later on the show, we're going to take a look at the effect of the Affordable Care Act in the state of Utah. But first up, we have these headlines. Music fans in Salt Lake City and all across Utah have been awaiting the lineup for the popular Twilight Concert Series, a run of summer concerts put on annually by the Salt Lake City Arts Council. On Thursday, the star-studded list of musical acts was announced to the public. KCPW's Ryan Cunningham has all the details.
Girls, you know you better.
That's Lauryn Hill you're hearing, and if you're going to the first Twilight concert this summer on July 10th, then you'll be hearing a lot more of her. Hill is scheduled to kick off the Twilight concert series this summer with opener Thundercat. Week 2 doesn't let up, with Twin Shadow opening for Art Rockers TV on the Radio on July 17th. July 24th brings a different vibe entirely to Pioneer Park, where the concerts are held. The Budos Band will be followed by classic soul singer Charles Bradley.
Oh, I love you, baby. I love you so dumb.
The month of July promises to go out with a bang. Run the Jewels performs before legendary hip-hop group Wu-Tang Clan takes over. August brings another change of pace with indie rockers Local Natives. Then on August 14th, a man who transcends all genres, Beck, who's preceded by synth-pop band Future Islands.
Destination, a little up the road from the habitations of the towns we know, a place we saw the lights.
If Wu-Tang wasn't enough 90s style hip-hop for you, then come back for more on August 21st when De La Soul performs. Twilight closes the season on August 28th with the first act that was announced, folk rockers The Head and the Heart.
How's that prickling coming? How's your
The Salt Lake City Arts Council organizes the annual Twilight Concert Series, now in its 27th year. Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker has put his full support behind the concerts, even starring in a promotional video with the Art Council's program manager, Jesse Schaefer. Tickets to each concert still cost $5, but season tickets can be purchased for $35. More information is available at twilightconcertseries.com. For KCPW News, I'm Ryan Cunningham.
The federal government is suing a for-profit college in Utah and Idaho because prosecutors say the school illegally recruited students. U.S. Attorney Wendy Olson announced the False Claims Act lawsuit against Stevens Henniger College Incorporated and its owner, the Center for Excellence in Higher Education, on Thursday. The Department of Justice and Department of Education allege the college paid incentives to recruiters based on the number of students they enrolled. Federal law prohibits those sorts of recruitment payments in an effort to reduce student loan default rates and to prevent unqualified students from being enrolled. The federal agencies brought the case after two former employees filed a whistleblower lawsuit against the college. Stevens Henniger College CEO Eric Julin says the lawsuit is without merit and that the school will vigorously defend itself. Stanford University announced on Tuesday that it would purge coal mining stocks from its nearly $19 billion endowment. The university's trustees based their decision on internal investment guidelines that call for the school to consider, quote, potential social injury that a company might cause. Here's Stanford spokesperson Brad Hayward explaining the decision.
The advisory committee and the trustees judged that coal is one of the most carbon-intensive methods of energy generation. And because of that, and also because of the availability of alternatives to coal, it's not a sector that Stanford wishes to invest in.
A nationwide campaign aims to get institutions of higher learning and other groups to rid their investment portfolio of fossil fuel stocks. Locally, a University of Utah student group has been campaigning since 2012 in the hopes of getting that school to sell off its coal stock and other investments related to climate change. Junior Matthew Kierkegaard is a co-founder of the Reinvest U student group. He applauded the decision by Stanford, saying it sets a precedent that the University of Utah and other institutions around the country should follow.
I think it's irresponsible and I would argue immoral for universities and public institutions as a whole to invest in really the fuels that are driving climate change and jeopardizing the future of, I'm 21, of my generation and of my children's generation and all generations after us. I mean, we're, after all, these are universities. They're supposed to be preparing their students for the world to come and for a public civic life. And I think that when you're investing in something that directly contradicts that, it's not only antithetical to your mission, it's just irresponsible.
University of Utah spokesperson Maria O'Mara said she wasn't aware of Kierkegaard's group and wasn't able to comment on how the school addresses decisions related to its endowment portfolio. Governor Gary Herbert has kicked off his first annual Outdoor Recreation Summit by signing a long-awaited swap of state and federal lands in Grand, San Juan, and Uinta counties. The governor, State Bureau of Land Management Director Juan Palma, and State Trust Lands Director Kevin Carter signed the deal on Thursday morning. The deal gives the federal government about 25,000 acres of conservation and recreation lands in exchange for about 35,000 acres of energy-rich land for the state. Congress authorized the deal in 2009, but it has taken years of negotiations to finalize. The signing of the deal came as government officials and representatives of Utah's booming outdoor industry met for the day-long summit in Salt Lake City. The day's agenda included discussions about public lands policy, business, recreation, and tourism. And finally today, traffic at Salt Lake City International Airport is back to normal after lightning struck about a dozen inbound planes on Wednesday. Spokeswoman Barbara Gann says 10 Delta flights and one United Airlines flight were struck. She says occasional strikes are normal, but adds that 11 instances in one day is unusually high. Gann said she didn't know where the planes were when the lightning hit. Some Thursday evening and Friday morning flights were canceled as maintenance crews checked on the airliners. And that does it for our summary of the day's top local headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and this is The Rundown. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Now on the show, we're going to turn to a conversation with Randall Sear, director of the Consumer Health Assistance Program Take Care Utah, about the effects of the Affordable Care Act in the state 6 months into its implementation. Randall Sear, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to be here.
So when we had you in last, it was September of last year, and enrollment had not yet begun. That first enrollment period closed at the end of March, and I know that there's some data to report. And so the first question that I have is, how many people in Utah have signed up for health insurance through the Affordable Care Act?
Well, in Utah, it was 84,000, over 84,000 people, right? And that number is still kind of ticking upward because there's people still wrapping up some complicated cases and things. But it's fascinating because the goal that we had at the beginning was, and this was given to us by the federal government, was to sign up 57,000 people just through the website in Utah. And so we exceeded that goal by 148%, which is incredible, really, considering all the rough takeoff and the problems with the website and those sorts of things. It was a crazy time.
Obviously, there's a lot of people who need health insurance, but I'm wondering why the number that they were shooting for was lower than what, you know, ended up happening.
I think it's hard to say. I'm just speculating, but I think the federal government wanted to set a realistic goal, right? Let's not aim for the moon and only be able to get to, you know, maybe outside of our atmosphere a little bit or something.
Yeah.
I think they were trying to set a realistic goal. And I think, you know, when we got to 84,000 people, I think it surprised everybody.
How is that number, the 84,000, where does that number come from?
Yeah, so the federal government keeps track of these numbers. obviously they have data. Every time somebody signs up on the website, they have that data federally that they can then accumulate and analyze, and then they released it to us about a month after the closing date. So we got that number that way.
Okay. So at the time that the law was launched, when the new law went into effect, a couple of things happened. One was that we were in the midst of a government shutdown, which may have complicated matters a little bit. But also, as you mentioned, there were some pretty sizable technological problems with the healthcare.gov website where people could sign up. What were those problems and how did they kind of resolve?
Yeah. Well, there were a lot of problems, but I would say first and foremost, it was simply that people just couldn't get in to apply, right? That was the biggest problem. You'd go on healthcare.gov and it would basically just give you the screen that says, you know, you can't get past this point. I don't know exactly what it said. There was a few different messages you could get, but so people really just couldn't apply. And the handful of groups that did get through, we pretty much found and were able to talk to them and ask them what it was like and those sorts of things. But yeah, it was really problematic for the first couple of months, right? People could start signing up technically on October 1st, but really people couldn't truly sign up until around the beginning of December. But once December 1st came, it was fascinating. It was like somebody turned on a switch and everybody was able to get through the website, or at least the vast majority of people.
And you started to see numbers really increase in terms of who was signing up. Will you remind our listeners what the Utah, I mean, you work for Take Care Utah, which is part of the Utah Health Policy Project. What is Utah Health Policy Project's role in this and Take Care Utah, and how are those different?
Yeah, so Utah Health Policy Project, the simplest way to explain that is it's a nonprofit organization that does healthcare policy on one side and then healthcare enrollment on the other side. Take Care Utah is a program of Utah Health Policy Project, United Way of Salt Lake 211, and the Association for Utah Community Health. And there's a bunch of different organizations involved in Take Care Utah. I run that program. So basically, I oversee this large group of people that are helping Utahns enroll in health insurance.
Going back to that enrollment and helping people enroll in health insurance, now that the enrollment period has closed, what does that mean for people who didn't sign up?
Yeah, so there's a few exceptions where actually if you weren't able to sign up by the 31st, there's a few exceptions where you still can sign up. For example, if somebody gets married, divorced, has a child, moves into the state, loses their insurance. There's some of these kind of exceptions where they still can get insurance. But if people, you know, didn't get their foot in the door before the deadline, didn't apply, they're going without insurance, if they are above the poverty level, then yeah, there's going to be some sort of fine when they do their taxes.
Well, how is that penalty collected?
So when everybody does their taxes for the year 2014, it'll have questions in there about your health insurance. And yeah, it's pretty simple. I think a lot of people actually saw questions about that already as kind of a reminder. Yeah, you need to get health insurance. But when you do your taxes in 2014, it'll be assessed whether or not you owe that penalty.
Actually, to get it out of the way, because I didn't ask this question, what is the penalty? What's that fine?
Well, it depends on your family size and your income. Just like when you sign up for insurance, your family size and your income will determine what sort of subsidy and what sort of help you can get. So it really varies depending on kind of what situation you're in. But there's also maximums that you would pay. You're not going to become bankrupt because of these penalties. There's a lot of concern that people are going to, you know, lose a lot of money by not having had health insurance. The first year, the penalties really aren't that stiff, but they kind of increase over the next few years to incentivize people to get insurance. You know, it kind of behooves you to get insurance after a while rather than paying a penalty because you're going to be spending that money anyways.
I know that UHPP lamented that there was so much understanding about the fines, but not a lot of people were aware of the credits that are available to help people buy insurance. What are those credits?
Yeah, so once again, depends on your family size, depends on your income, and sometimes a couple of other things that they might take into account. But one thing that we found that was fascinating, it was really interesting, was, you know, generally speaking in Utah, it's a very red state, very conservative state. There's a lot of kind of anti-federal government fervor. There's some anti-President Obama fervor out there. And, you know, people are just kind of angry. We get these calls where people were just expressing anger and they weren't really sure what they were angry about oftentimes, or there was a lot of misinformation. You know, so we'd sit there and especially for the first 2 months when the website wasn't working, what we were doing was we were on the phones talking to people, answering questions over and over and over again. You know, the phones were just ringing off the hook. And so we'd start answering their questions. They'd start to get a better understanding of what it really is. And we'd get them in and sit down, you know, and not everybody was completely calm at that point. Some people were kind of begrudgingly signing up for health insurance, you know. But what generally happened, the most fascinating part, was as soon as people found out, oh, nearly 90% of people that sign up for health insurance through healthcare.gov get help paying for their health insurance. And once they found that out, once they found out that it was actually affordable for them, rather than all of this minutiae getting lost in the penalties and the fines and, you know, government intrusion in your lives, people would begrudgingly sign up for health insurance. And they'd end up pretty happy with what they got.
I was going to ask about that, the feedback that you're getting on this, because, I mean, the whole point of it is to make healthcare more affordable. And I think, yeah, a lot of people were fixated on the mandate, which was a requirement, a deal breaker for the insurance companies. Right. Otherwise, they weren't going to be on board with this. But so what kind of feedback are you getting in terms of what people are saying about their insurance?
Most people are happy with it, right? It's typically more comprehensive insurance, meaning they have more benefits than they used to have. A lot of people had insurance and they were happy with it because it was relatively cheap. Now, this is, you know, one group of people. There's a lot of different categories I could put people in. But most people left happy with what they got because it's every insurance plan that you get through, quote unquote, Obamacare has to meet a certain standard. Right, there have to be certain benefits included, maternity coverage, mental health coverage, those sorts of things that a lot of plans didn't include before. So most people left happy because they got those plans, and they most of them got them at a very affordable price.
I wanted to ask, you just brought up something that I think is interesting, which is that there are these minimum standards, these mandatory standards that the policy has to meet. Is that across the board, even for people who have plans that are outside of the healthcare.gov insurance that you get that way? I mean, now is it that all health insurance plans have to meet that standard?
Generally speaking, yes, but there's an exception to nearly every rule in life, right? So generally speaking, yes, every plan that's offered now has to meet that certain standard. You have to have good health insurance, I guess is the way I would explain it. But, you know, there's been sort of some exceptions. They've said if you have insurance, you can allow that plan, you can stay on that plan for an extra year, kind of through this adjustment period. So what we expect to see, for example, towards the end of this year, is a lot of people had these grandfathered plans that are no longer going to be acceptable, and they'll have to find better insurance, essentially. There's also some public programs that many people have heard of, maybe not. There's one called PCN that you get through the state of Utah, which I refer to as kind of Medicaid Lite. Mm-hmm. It basically covers preventive care, those sorts of things, checkups. But anything beyond that, really, not too much is covered. So there's exceptions, but generally speaking, yeah, every plan has to comply with those standards now.
Hmm. Okay. Are there, in terms of changing public opinions, are there new kinks, new solutions? I guess I'm wondering if there are kind of new revelations about the insurance marketplace, about the Affordable Care Act. I know you were really busy in the month of March and February because people were suddenly signing up, but I'm wondering if there's sort of a new sense of what this is.
You know, I don't think we're going to see that reflected in the polls just yet. I think people have to use their insurance and see what it's like and see if they're happy with it. But what was really interesting was more people signed up in the month of March than had signed up in the previous 5 months that people could start to enroll. So you can imagine how busy, you know, our office was, among many other offices around the state.
That last month, there was this rush to do it, and then the door closes, the window is shut, and it's just dead, basically, right? Nobody else is signing.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me of, you know, a carnival worker. The carnival's up, it's really busy, everybody's having fun, it's a crazy time, and then the doors close, and it's kind of eerily quiet. You know, April 1st came around, and we went from running around, answering phones, taking walk-ins, taking appointments, trying to help as many people as possible for, you know, what turned into 10 or 11-hour days for a lot of people, sometimes more. But then, you know, the deadline passed, and it really slowed down to a kind of an eerie pace. It was a quick change.
Are things changing in any way for the next enrollment period? And maybe you can remind us again when that starts and what people have to do.
Yeah, so the next enrollment period isn't until November 15th, and it's going to last 3 months, so through the middle of February. Now, that might change, right? Who knows? They might adjust that period or extend it somehow to kind of line up with tax enrollment season or things like that. But essentially, yeah, they might make a few adjustments here or there, but I would hope especially that the website is working more consistently and better for everybody. You know, there's still a few different groups of people that are having problems getting through the website, specifically those that don't have a credit history or immigrants. They have trouble. The website has trouble identifying those people and verifying that they are who they say they are. So, yeah, there's groups like that that are still struggling. I imagine they'll get the kinks worked out over the next 6 months. I would really hope anyways. But the law and the requirements of the law that people have to have health insurance, nothing there really changes.
What about in the interim? You know, there's this, this is part of the law, essentially between now and November 15th, you know, there's not open enrollment, but you can sign up for health insurance under certain circumstances under the law, right?
Yeah. So once again, life-changing experiences, getting married, divorced, having a child, moving to the state. There's a few other victims of domestic violence. There's some of these different categories where people can still get health insurance, but that's only through the website, right? People can get insurance on their own outside of the website if they really want it, and if they can find it at an affordable price, which is the kicker, right? Mm. And Medicaid and CHIP are year-round, actually. So if anybody qualifies for Medicaid or CHIP, they can apply for that at any point.
Whenever.
Yeah.
And is that something, is Medicare and CHIP something that the Taker Utah Health Policy Project can help with people getting enrolled on?
Yep. We help with Medicaid, CHIP, private insurance, insurance through the website. What we don't generally have the expertise to help with is Medicare, right, which is insurance for generally those above 65 years of age.
Right.
And we can't help through the small business marketplace website,
which is a state-run website, right? There's a distinction there.
Correct. And that website is also open throughout the year, so people can get insurance through that website throughout the year if they are interested as a small business.
I'm trying to remember what the name of it is. It has an
Avenue H.
That's right. Yep. Okay, and that's, I mean, that there's a whole other discussion we could have here about how some states are doing it differently than other states. I know that we are one of a number of states that have decided to run our own small business, this Avenue H mm-hmm. website. And then we could also have a conversation about federal Medicaid expansion and what's going on with that. I mean, we're still in a waiting period here in Utah, right?
Correct, yeah. So one thing I would point out about that is probably about half of the people that we talked to fell into that Medicaid gap, meaning ironically, their income was too low to qualify for any sort of affordable health insurance at the moment. So we're really hopeful that Medicaid expansion or some form of Medicaid expansion or some way that group can get health insurance is going to come through and pass hopefully over the summer.
Be they block grants from the federal government or full Medicaid expansion or another plan that is in the works that we don't know about.
Right. So what seems most likely at the moment, and once again, this is kind of a complicated topic, but what seems most likely at the issue at the moment is Governor Herbert's plan, which is called Healthy Utah, which is essentially be a block grant to provide health insurance, private health insurance, to that low-income population, which to give you ideas, for one person, they would have to make less than $11,490 a year, and then they would qualify for this plan. So we're hopeful that something along those lines would go through.
Do you know how many people does that affect?
Well, of those that are below, like I said, for 100% poverty level, which is $11,490 a year for one person, and you know it goes up depending on how many people are in the family or in the household. But so those below poverty level, $11,490 a year for one person, that would be roughly 60,000 people in Utah. Now that's just one estimate. But if you take it up, which it might end up being anybody below 138% of poverty level, you know, that number increases quite a bit to, I think, close to 100,000 people.
Randall Sear is with the Utah Health Policy Project, Take Care Utah. Thanks very much for coming in and helping us sort through this. Remind our listeners one more time when the next enrollment for health insurance is.
Yeah, November 15th. But if there's any life-changing circumstance you have, feel free to contact us, takecareutah.org, or you can call 211 and get your questions answered.
Fantastic. Thanks again for coming in.
Always a good time.
And again, that was Randall Sear, director of Take Care Utah, which is the Consumer Health Assistance Program of the Utah Health Policy Project. You can find this conversation and all of our past interviews at our website, kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're listening to The Rundown. We'll be right back. And thanks again for tuning into The Rundown this afternoon. Our show was produced, as always, by Lauren Colucci. We had additional help from Papa Tyler Ford and Ryan Cunningham. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Tomorrow on the program, we bring you the next in a series from Explore Utah Science, looking at watersheds and the water supply in the Salt Lake region. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for tuning in. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are next.